Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. John Maynor is a professor of political science. Actually, is it full professor or
associate
professor? Is teaching a class this summer, a senior seminar, subtitled Perspectives on Politics, Citizenship, and Community in a Globalized World. And it runs from June the 1st through July the 2nd. Of course, as concentrated as the summer courses are, it runs 4 days a week. It's going to give students a chance to do something a little bit different because summer courses let you get out and about in ways that traditional fall and spring courses don't. Dr. Maynor is here to talk with us today about the whole concept behind this and what his students are going to be working on. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
What does this expression mean to you, citizenship and community in a globalized world? What do you envision when you say that term?
Well, there's a traditional conception of the citizen that has the citizen holding a great deal of allegiance toward their nation state. They are, at least in the case of the United States, they are part owners of their nation state. And as such, they have on one hand, they have a certain status that being a citizen of the United States gives them. And on the other hand, they have certain obligations toward the United States since we are a democracy. So there are certain requirements for the successful functioning of our government. The challenge that we face today is that due to the forces of globalization, the scope of the nation state to exercise its traditional power has become challenged due to the increased forces of globalization. And of course, globalization is a catchword that a lot of people talk about, not a lot of people fully understand. Globalization is a process that sees the spatial area of the state challenged. The world, as they say, is becoming smaller due to advances in communication, advances in technology, the interdependence of the global economic market. And the nation state is really being challenged from a number of areas. And one of the things that we try to look at in the course is how the challenge of globalization has affected the traditional role of the citizen, because no longer do you see people necessarily being blindly aligned with their nation state. They have the opportunity to align themselves with a whole host of other bodies, some of them public, some of them non-public. So the course really tries to, from a theoretical and a practical perspective, try to explore some of these challenges.
There is no more Cold War, no two superpowers fighting it out for world supremacy and the allegiance of weaker nations or the developing world. So is the playing field closer to being level? Is the world really flat, like Thomas Friedman implies in his book?
I don't think the world is flat. I think that there is a number of divisions which are maybe divisions which cannot be reconciled. There is tension, obviously, in a cultural and a religious perspective. There is tension, importantly, especially today, in an economic sense between the developed countries and the developing countries. One of the things that we've seen in the last 5 years is the rise of China as an economic power, the rise of a country like India as an economic power. And these countries are not content to take the status of second world that they were once sometimes given. Then you have other countries which are emerging from what we used to kind of call the third world, countries in Latin America, for example, Brazil, which is coming online and building a more stable economic base. And these countries are not content to be dictated to by the traditional world powers, as it were. They are demanding more respect and more attention. And it's interesting that in the economic crisis that we've just had, which, of course, the United States has played an unfortunate role in, that many countries who got into trouble did not necessarily first come to the United States to get out of trouble. And that's a sign that the United States, while it may still be the only remaining superpower, it's certainly not the only remaining relevant country.
When John Locke wrote about the social contract between the citizen and his government, did he also conceive of a social contract between a person as a citizen of the world and the rest of the world? And even if he didn't, is it possible to see oneself in terms of that kind of social contract?
Well, of course, John Locke would not have been familiar with the types of problems that we face today. He would have been familiar, however, with many of the ideals that our country holds very dear. One of the recent developments that we have seen is a pressure to try to detach liberal democratic ideas from the nation state. So in the sense that if one makes a contract based on the primacy of liberal democratic ideas, the question then becomes, what is the entity that's going to guarantee those ideals? And over the last probably 25 years, you've had an experiment in Europe, which is very interesting. And of course, what I'm talking about is the evolution of the European Union. What started out as an economic common market has now become a full-blown governmental supranational entity. And it's interesting to note that in Europe, if you are a citizen of a member state of the European Union, you have, in essence, a form of dual citizenship, so that you are a citizen of your home state, for example, the United Kingdom. If you're a citizen of the UK, you're also a citizen of the European Union. And as such, you have certain rights and responsibilities that are focused not only on your member state, the United Kingdom in my example, but also on the European Union. You also have the right to take your member state to court for any type of perceived violation of your rights. So there is an important check on the power of that nation state. The European Union also has, through its treaty system, a de facto constitution. And there are efforts, halting efforts, because they've run into some trouble, some political trouble, in trying to actually develop a formal European constitution. And again, this challenges the traditional notion of the nation state, because one would have a social contract with not only their nation state, but with an entity that sits above the nation state, the European Union. So this development is something certainly still in progress, but it is a challenge to the traditional formulation of political power and the power of the nation state.
How does the whole concept of citizenship and community in a globalized world square with the traditional sense of American, quote-unquote, rugged individualism, we take care of ourselves attitude? There's something to be said for that. The country wouldn't have been formed without that attitude, probably. But on the other hand, there are pockets in this country where people are more inclined to say, I'm doing well enough to keep body and soul together. I can't be concerned with what's going on in Pakistan or Sudan or Sri Lanka or wherever. And you couple that with the reduction of foreign coverage in the American media in the past several years due to budget reductions. And you wonder if we're knowledgeable enough or informed enough to be full participants in a globalized world?
Well, there are two answers to that. And while they're related, they do go in different territories. So let me take on the most obvious answer to that first, is that, again, because of the forces of globalization, which has brought the world's disparate regions closer. Of course, not physically, but via transportation, technology, communication, global economic interdependence. It matters a lot what goes on in Pakistan. It matters a lot what goes on in Afghanistan. It matters a lot what goes on in the Sudan, because forces in those countries have demonstrated that they are able to take their differences with the United States to the shores of the United States. So it matters how the United States deals with Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Sudan in a very personable way, because we have seen the ability of those who don't like the United States to exact some type of war against us. So in that sense, due to the forces of globalization, the nation state is not this impenetrable fortress that it was. So we need to be engaging on those issues and in these areas. The other answer to that question is somewhat more philosophical, and it's actually another of the things that we look at in the course. And we start out looking at Alexis de Tocqueville's travel diary that he kept when he was traveling around in the United States during the Jacksonian era. And one of the things that concerned him was that America somehow had figured out how to make democracy work. And America, at the time, was the only country successfully executing a democratic government. In Tocqueville's home country of France at the time, he's writing in the 1830s. And in 1789, of course, we had the French Revolution. And what started out as a great statement of liberal democracy quickly devolved into what was called the Reign of Terror, where anyone who was an enemy became violently disposed of. And so Tocqueville was amazed that the democracy, which they had such high hopes for in France, had gone so sour, and he was amazed that America somehow had figured out how to avoid these problems. And one of the things that he pointed to was the ability of the American citizen to take an active role in governing themselves. So much so that when it came to looking at the duties that one has to do in order to be an active citizen, it was done through what Tocqueville would describe as a habit of the heart. It was something, it was a norm, something that people accepted as being a constituent part of their own freedom. And in part, they had an attitude that they owned the government, that they had a proprietary relationship with the government. So therefore, when they were called upon to do public service, it wasn't viewed as something that was counterintuitive to their sense of individualism, but something that was a necessary part of their individualism. But the question that Tocqueville always had is, could the Americans keep this virtuous image of the individual from becoming the unvirtuous reality of the selfish, egoist individual? And that was one of the challenges that Tocqueville identified, was the tension between a kind of benign individualism and a very malicious form of selfishness. And many commentators, as we look at in the course, would argue that from the high point of when Tocqueville was writing, we've become more selfish, and therefore our individualism is not so much individualism, but it's narrow self-interest, which is counterproductive to a successful maintenance of a democracy.
And also counterproductive to, if taken to an extreme, I suppose, to being a full-fledged member of the global community, one would think.
Yes, of course. And Tocqueville would be very concerned with this because there is a sense that if you wall yourself off from the global community, that you somehow elevate yourself above others. And this can only lead to a conflictual situation, a situation that can only be resolved through quite probably physical conflict. And in some ways, we have witnessed that to a certain degree.
When it doesn't just manifest itself, this selfishness you're talking about, in isolationism at various periods in American history, but do you think it could have been reflected in the so-called Bush Doctrine of the prior administration, in which posited that the United States had a right to act unilaterally and not in concert with others necessarily in order to protect what it thought was its own best interests?
Well, this is another actually thing that we look at in the course, where the students do some group projects together, and one of the questions that one of the groups answers is, are preemptive strikes just? And typically what happens is that students will take what is known as just war theory, which is something which evolved out of medieval Christian ethics into something more secular, and ask the question, is it just to preemptively strike somebody or to have a preemptive war? And of course, students are completely free to come, make whatever decision that they want to, whether they are or they're not. A lot of times, what happens is that people make good arguments on both sides. The question has to do with whether certain conditions of just war theory can be met, certain things like having a just cause, proportionality, having the right to act sanctioned by a body, an authoritative body, these types of things. And when it comes to the issue of the Bush Doctrine, it can be very split. There are some who believe that it is just to strike before you are going to be struck. The problem is that within just war theory, there's always this notion of proportionality. And so, as with any kind of preemptive strike or preventative war, you've got to look at the proportionality of the response. So then we get into certain situations that we're actually seeing even today. President Obama during the campaign and now has always said that it's fair game to go after Osama bin Laden, even if he's in Pakistan, a country that we're currently not at war with, and that we can go after Osama bin Laden without their permission. And one of the things that we've seen even in the last 2 weeks are strikes from these unmanned drones, which are flying around in certain parts of Afghanistan and in Pakistan along the border. And the question becomes, is it just to target a bad person when good people or innocent people might be also killed? In the military, they call this collateral damage. However, if you are on the ground and you're doing nothing wrong, and all of a sudden someone comes and blows you up, it's hard to see that there's any claim of justice there. So these are very complicated questions. There are no clear answers to them. And it's not a moral issue which is simply confined to the Bush administration. It's something that the Obama people have quickly figured out. There's a lot of gray area.
In addition to the just war theory exercise, what other types of things will you have your students do that maybe a summer course gives you the freedom to try out that you wouldn't be able to do in a fall or a spring course?
Well, one of the things that we're able to do in the course is, as I mentioned earlier, we do have a series of group projects that students do. And in order to try to get them prepared and bonded as a group working on a common project, typically for during the first week of the course, we go to the campus recreation center and we spend 2 days there doing team building exercises. Part of the service that Campus Rec provides is what they call the challenge course, and there are typically two components to this. There are low challenges and then there's a high challenge, and on the first day we do low challenges. These are challenges which low would mean they take place on the ground. So there are kind of problem-solving exercises that the students do both as a large group, but as smaller groups. And then we go back another day and we do the high challenge. And if anyone's ever been to Campus Rec, you may have seen in the back there's a large wooden structure that is called the Alpine Tower. And essentially what it is a vertical obstacle course which requires someone to climb up and to choose a certain route up to the top.
The ROTC boys and girls are very good at that.
Yes, that's right. So we climb that tower, and a couple of things happen from this exercise is that students figure out certain team building skills and they have to practice them quite literally. And then second of all, they bond as a group. And this is always very important to have a group of people who feel like they know one another, who can be serious when it's time to be serious and also be not so serious when it's time to not be so serious.
Especially since the time of your summer session is compressed. You have much less time than you would in a full fall or spring semester.
That's right. So the students really need to bond quickly, and classes that bond quickly typically are better classes. So we're able to take what we learn outside of class and move that inside of class in a series of group projects. We have a first smaller group project, which there's a couple of books, one called Bowling Alone, which was written by a political scientist called Robert Putnam, who has a theory that this is following on from what I mentioned earlier about Tocqueville, that Americans have become more singular. And he uses the metaphor of bowling to say that 30, 40 years ago, there were a number of very vibrant bowling leagues throughout the country. And while today we bowl at the same level that we used to bowl at, in other words, the same number of people, the same percentage of people participate in bowling, they don't bowl together. They go in narrow groups. The leagues have fallen off and they've suffered. And the metaphor is that while we're still active in the public, we're not active together in the traditional sense that we used to be active at. And we've lost a certain sense of community. So the first group project asked students to take parts of that book and analyze it and then present it in a seminar format, which, of course, the 2.5-hour class period during the summer allows us to really build up some very positive critical depth. We then move on to look at a critique of Putnam by a guy called Dalton, who revisits the theme of community and citizenship. And it's written, Putnam, you could say, is very old school, whereas Dalton is very new school. He's very interested in how young people are engaging in politics today. So we're able to focus on certain facets of contemporary politics, like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, the YouTubification of politics.
Blogs and chat rooms.
We're able to try to ask qualitative questions about whether these new forms of engagement are, you know, have either replaced the old forms of engagement, or are they better, or are they worse? What is the upside? What is the downside? And then we move into a larger group project in which there are several questions that the students, their groups can choose from. And we introduce the concept of globalization to ask how globalization has affected, you know, citizenship and community. Again, the summer format allows us the time and the space to watch some movies, watch some documentaries, things like that, which we normally wouldn't be able to do in an hour-long class. Or, you know, if you're having to spread a documentary over two or three class sessions, you kind of lose the impact. And by the time it comes to the end of it, people have generally moved on.
Or not at all.
Or not at all, as it were. So the summer format allows us the ability to reach, you know, quite a bit of critical depth in a short amount of time. And, of course, it's summer. Everyone's more relaxed. If the weather's nice and it's suitable, we can go outside. We can go and do alternative classroom setting. I just like the students, you know, if it's a sunny day and it's pleasant out, I'd much rather be outside than inside.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to do that. And we're able to take advantage of the format of the summer.
The course is called Perspectives on Politics, Citizenship and Community in a Globalized World. It's Political Science 4800 Senior Seminar. Starts June the 1st. And if you want to know more about it, send an email to do Dr. John Maynor at jmaynor@mtsu.edu. And your office phone number is
494-8758.
With a 615 area code if you happen to be out of the area code. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Maynor.
Thank you for having me.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. You can catch the podcast at mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.